Plagues and portents. The biblical story does not present the departure from Egypt as an everyday occurrence, but rather as an event accompanied by violent upheavals of nature. Grave and ominous signs preceded the Exodus. Clouds of dust and smoke darkened the sky and colored the water they fell upon with a bloody hue. The dust tore wounds in the skin of man and beast. In the torrid glow, vermin and reptiles bred and filled air and earth. Wild beasts, plagued by sand and ashes, came from the ravines of the wastelands to the abodes of men. A terrible torrent of hailstones fell, and a wild fire ran upon the ground. A gust of wind brought swarms of locusts, which obscured the light. Blasts of cinders blew in wave after wave. Day and night, night and day, and the gloom grew to a prolonged night, and blackness extinguished every ray of light. Then came the tenth and most mysterious plague. The angel of the Lord, quote, passed over the houses of the children of Israel, when he smote the Egyptians, and delivered our houses. Exodus chapter 12, verse 27. The slaves, spared by the angel of destruction, were implored amid groaning and weeping to leave the land the same night. In the ash-gray dawn, the multitude moved, leaving behind scorched fields and ruins where a few hours before had been urban and rural habitations. There are two scholarly approaches to this story of the plagues as told in Exodus chapters 7 through 11. One holds it to be a fairy tale. The story was taken apart and analyzed, and it was found that originally the legend had told of the death of the crown prince. Then the death of one person was expanded into a plague that was inflicted on all the firstborn. Later on, one plague was increased to three, but the storytellers, still not satisfied, continued to spin out their tale until they had a story in 10 episodes. With precision, the authorship of Elohist and Yahwist was discerned. Quote, neither group of legends has any historical truth at its source. The plagues are a later substitution for older miracles. However, miracles have never occurred anywhere. End quote. Quote, and since neither the plagues nor the miracles are historical, no conclusion can be drawn about the time of the Exodus. End quote. And when a purely realistic analysis was applied, the lever technique of the narrators was exposed. Quote, these are scholarly reflections. By the hail, only flax and barley were destroyed because they already were ripe, and the wheat with the rye were spared because they used to ripen later. This gloss was added in order that at the next plague, the locusts should have something to devour. Etwas zu fressen haben. End quote. Sometimes the tale spinners' self-control failed, as can be seen in the story of the boils. Quote, pest boils don't fly like ashes in the air, and still, Moses was made to sprinkle the ashes of the furnace, quote, toward the heaven. The other approach tried to find a natural explanation for the plagues. In Egypt, the sirocco blows on the fall and in the spring. The hot wind is also called kamsin, meaning 50. Because for 50 days in the year, this breath from the desert brings clouds of dust. Pictures were produced to show the darkened sky on a day when the kamsin blew. The desert wind may bring clouds of locusts. They cover the sky like a screen so that during their passage the sun's disk is obscured. The brownish color of the waters of the Nile, especially before it overflows, is well known to all tourists, and certain special observations near the cataracts of the Nile were described in detail. The lice, fleas, and frogs of the Egypt of today have been the subject of attentive study by reverend authors. It has been repeatedly pointed out that the order of the plagues as described in the Book of Exodus is exactly the order of the annual discomforts caused by the climate and insects of Egypt under Turkish rule, and is largely the same today. This approach to the problem of the plagues makes of them a year-in and year-out occurrence. Little wonder, then, that they impressed the Egyptians in the same measure as the year-in, year-out entry and departure of some Bedouins with their cattle. For hundreds of years, thousands of scholars have paid tribute to the story of the plagues. If pious, they have not asked questions. If enlightened, they have defended the narrative, proving that wonders are but trivial phenomena. If critical, they have rejected the story, explaining it as a myth of relatively late origin. The Book of Exodus then proceeds to tell how the Israelites were pursued by the army of the king, who regretted their escape. They were trapped between mountains and sea. The night was frightful. A heavy cloud darkened the sky, which was rent by incessant lightning. A hurricane raged the whole night, and at dawn the sea was cleft, the waters torn by a double tide of gigantic force. The slaves passed through, the pursuers followed in chariots, but the water returned, and the Egyptians, with their king fleeing against them, met their death in the waves. Attempts were made to explain this story as a natural phenomenon. It seemed difficult to give credence to its miraculous element. But the vivid description of the night, the hurricane, and the mountainous waves suggested that some event had actually taken place, the memory of which was later clothed in fantastic elaborations. The constant return, through the centuries, of Jewish thought to some experience by the sea also suggested that not the whole story had been invented. Historians agree that the most precious tradition of the people was born on the shores of the Yam Suf, generally translated as Red Sea. A river or sea, cleft in two, is a frequent motif in folklore. The pursuers probably experienced some catastrophe, not because of a sea rent in twain, but because of a tide swollen by the storm. But an explanation based on ebb and flood tides is obviously invalid. Whether the Sea of Passage was the Gulf of Suez, or the Gulf of Aqaba on the Red Sea, or Lake Sirbonis, Serbon, connected with the Mediterranean, or some other lake, the Crocodile Lake, the Salt Lake, through the waters of which ships pass today from the Mediterranean into the Red Sea, there are no perceptible movements of flood and ebb on any of these water surfaces, either the Mediterranean or the Red Sea, of course, the inland seas, lakes. A more plausible explanation would therefore omit the tides and content itself with the storm. Some of the chariots of the pursuing Egyptians sank in the sea when its billows broke over the shore. Then the Israelites sang their song of deliverance, or received the inspiration out of which the exaggerated picture of the catastrophe was later born. How could it be otherwise than exaggerated when the annals of Egypt know nothing about the sea engulfing a king in his chariots, while the descendants of the fugitive from royal bondage glorified themselves with a story of miraculous storm unwitnessed by the Egyptians? Is there then any use in endeavoring to show that a strong east wind, blowing from evening till dawn, could force the sea to retreat, and that a change in the direction of the wind could overwhelm an army marching on land? Strange indeed is the persistence with which the Jewish people have clung to this story, making it the beginning and at the same time the most dramatic episode of their history as a nation. The fugitives, after their escape, entered a desert, a desolate wasteland. The Book of Exodus relates that a pillar of smoke went before them by day and a pillar of fire by night. A simple explanation of this portent has been found. At the head of wandering caravans, a torch is usually carried lifted high to show the way to the moving train. Because of the heat of the day, caravans prefer to move at night, and the burning and smoking pitch is intended to prevent anyone from being lost and to frighten the beasts of the desert. Although this explanation is the one that is accepted and found in numerous Bible dictionaries, it is too simple. The pillar of smoke and fire deeply impressed the Israelites. It was said to be the angel of God. Did the Israelites not know the manner and custom of caravans journeying in the desert, and were they so impressed by common things and so anxious for wonders that the torch in the hand of the leader became for them an angel? But the pillar of cloud and of fire could have been less than illusion and only the invention of storytellers. In the last century, an Englishman named Charles Beake, a man of more than one strange idea, published a pamphlet entitled Mount Sinai, a Volcano. On the title page, he placed an epigraph of two sentences, one from the Book of Exodus, the other from the Greek poet Pindar. The verse from Exodus chapter 13, verse 21 reads, quote, "By day in a pillar of cloud to lead them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light," end quote. The lines from Pindar, Odes Pythia 1, pages 22 and 23, describes Etna, quote, "By day a burning stream of smoke, but by night a ruddy eddying flame," end quote. Beginning with this parallel and going over to the biblical description of the day of the law-giving, Beek came to the startling conclusion expressed in the title of his pamphlet. The day of the law-giving is described in these words, quote, "And it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount, and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud, so that all the people that was in the camp trembled, and Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, and the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly. And all the people saw the thunderings, and the lightnings, and the noise of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed, and stood afar off." End quote. Beek explained the pillar of smoke and fire as the ignited column of ashes and vapors erupted by the volcano. He cited instances from volcanic regions showing that volcanic eruptions can produce black clouds of ashes that darken the sky and are sometimes swept over great distances. Eruptions are usually accompanied by rumblings in the bowels of the earth. Earthquakes and eruptions are often concurrent phenomena. Earthquakes that shake the bottom of the sea create tidal waves that may retreat from the shore and then return to engulf the land, leaving destruction in their wake. At the Sea of Passage, according to this explanation, an earthquake created havoc, and the reference to chariots that were unable to move, Exodus chapter 14, verse 25, has its parallel in the description of the earthquake that accompanied the eruption of Vesuvius in the year 79 when Pompeii and Herculaneum perished, a description preserved in a letter from Pliny the Younger to Tacitus, Epistles 6, page 20. Quote, "We stood still in the midst of a most dangerous and dreadful scene. The chariots, which we had ordered to be drawn out, were so agitated backwards and forwards, though upon the most level ground, that we could not keep them steady, even by supporting them with large stones. The sea seemed to roll back upon itself, and to be driven from its shores by the convulsive motion of the earth." End quote. The interpretation of the wondrous events at the Sea of Passage and at Mount Sinai as seismic and volcanic phenomena of nature met most vigorous opposition and derision from high ecclesiastics. Quote, "It is well known that no volcanic phenomena exist in the desert to account for these appearances. In fact, all the expressions used in the sacred writers are those which are usually employed in the Hebrew scriptures to describe a thunderstorm." End quote. Beek did not regard the mountainous heights of the Sinai Peninsula as the Mount Sinai of the scriptures. He had previously published a work arguing for the fallacious notion that the Mizraim of the scriptures was not Egypt, but some vanished kingdom on the Sinai Peninsula. The Israelites, when leaving the country, crossed the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba and came into the Arabian shore of that gulf. He announced that he was staking his reputation as a traveler and biblical scholar, and that, granted public assistance, he would locate Mount Sinai and Har Rajla, quote, "which was formerly in activity, but has now been extinct during many ages," end quote. An old man, he followed, as he thought, in the footsteps of the prophet Elijah, who also made his pilgrimage to the mountain in the desert. When he returned, declaring that Mount Sinai is Har Nur, Mount of Fire, east of Gor, a peak that, like a number of others, has a halo around it but does not appear to have been a volcano, he wrote that he was, quote, "egregiously mistaken with respect to the volcanic character of Mount Sinai," end quote. His confession was published posthumously in a gilt-edged volume, very different in appearance from Mount Sinai, a volcano. It gave an account of the voyage, quote, "I am therefore bound to confess that I was in error as regards the physical character of Mount Sinai, and that the appearances mentioned in Scripture were as little volcanic as they were tempestuous," end quote. 30 years after the theory of the volcanic character of Sinai was enunciated, it was adopted by one scholar, 10 years later by a few others, and recently, the idea that Yahweh was a local deity of a volcano has become an oft-repeated notion. Its acceptance, however, has not prevented some scholars from denying the historicity of the visit of wandering Israelites to Mount Sinai.